Hi everyone, Drew Perot here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. In today's episode, we have Afif Ghanoom and Dr. Mahmoud Ghanoom here to talk about their research in the space of the mycobiome, the fungi that work in conjunction with our bacteria to keep us healthy when they're in the right balance. Super fascinating interview. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep in the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, functional medicine, mindset, and more. I'm your host, Drew Perot, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and most importantly, live more. This week's guest, our father and son team, Dr. Mahmoud Ghanoom and Afif Ghanoom. Welcome to Broken Brain Podcast.
Thanks for having us.
A little background on my guests that are here. Dr. G is a tenured professor and director of the Center for Medical Mycology at Case Western University and University Hospitals Cleveland Medical Center in Cleveland, Ohio. He spent his entire career studying medically important fungi and publishing extensively about their virtuous factors, especially in microbial biofilms. Dr. G is the scientist that named and coined the term the mycobiome, the fungal community in the body. Over his career, Dr. G has published over 450 peer-reviewed papers, and his work has been cited in over 21,000 pieces of literature. He has been actively funded by the NIH continuously since 1991 for his work studying the fungal and bacterial communities in our bodies, with a total of over $25 million in NIH funding to date. Dr. G was dubbed the scientist who is now known as the leading microbiome researcher in the world by the Washington Post, and is also the founder of the leading antifungal clinical testing company in the world, Next Trillion Sciences. He has been involved in the development of 95% of antifungals that have come to the market since the 1990s. Impressive bio.
Thank you very much. You are too kind.
Yes. Afif is a biotechnology attorney by training who turned biotechnology innovations into consumer products that have sold in over 27,000 retail locations in the United States. He has also licensed the technology to the global pharmaceutical company that has now sold in over 100,000 retail locations. Afif is currently the CEO of Biome Health, where he has commercialized consumer probiotics and microbiome testing kits around the dual role that fungi and bacteria play in the digestive tract. Afif, a pleasure to have you and your father here on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
I know we've been in touch, and just the work that you guys are doing together and separately is incredible. And I'm so excited because we've done so many podcasts on the gut microbiome from all different standpoints, including many of our mutual friends that we've had on the podcast here. But this time, not that we're not going to dive deep into the microbiome, but we're going to be talking about this term that is still very new for a lot of people, the mycobiome. So let's start with that, right? So there's so many pieces to the gut microbiome, and as we dig deeper and deeper, we realize that it's even more complex than we can ever imagine. So what is the mycobiome, and what's its relation to our gut bacteria?
I think this is very, very nice point to bring up too, because up till now, a lot of the work, when you hear about the microbiome, you hear about bacteria. But in fact, in addition to the bacteria in and on our body, we have fungus, which is mycobiome,
MY,
as well as viruses and other organisms as well, such as parasites. So my work, as you said, is the mycobiome. And mycobiome is all over us. Like, you can find fungus in our skin, in our oral cavity, in our gut. And for years, this have not been recognized. The good news is that people now started to know that we have both bacteria and fungus, and that's where we play a role in really clarifying this and how to control this.
So we've known about why it's important for the microbiome, but why are people starting to know now, especially through your research, about why fungi and the microbiome is so important?
Because if you think about it, bacteria and fungus, they live in the same environment. And they are like little kids playing in a sandbox. Sometimes they come work together, sometimes to help us, sometimes to help themselves, and sometimes to hurt us as hosts. So for us, I knew that organisms such as bacteria and fungi live together long time ago, when I first started to do my doctorate in England in the 70s. What I learned is that if you give somebody an antibiotic, guess what happens? You kill all the bacteria, and lo and behold, fungus or the microbiome takes over and start causing trouble. And that's why we are trying to bring now, after so many years, we are trying to let people be aware that we really need to look at both bacteria and fungus, because when they play together, they could be good to us or they could be bad to us.
Afif, you know, when you're on the business side of this in creating consumer technologies and solutions to help educate people. So I'm sure you get this question all the time. So to piggyback off of what your dad was just sharing, when you give the elevator pitch to individuals about why is it so important to understand the microbiome and aren't they the same thing, what are the distinctions that you like to share with people to get them interested in this topic? Why is it so important?
Yeah, the thing is, it can get into the weeds really quickly. And obviously when you're talking to consumers, it has to be something that they understand. And really the simplest way to explain it is, listen, your gut has bacteria and fungi. Really, your probiotic should too. Your microbiome tests should cover both, right? And the thing is that people don't understand is that for every, you'll hear a lot of people say that, well, there's a lot more bacteria in the gut than fungi. But if you see a picture of the two together, it's like Gulliver's Travel, where the fungi is about 10 times bigger in size than bacteria. So really what you're doing, if you're not addressing both bacteria and fungi, and it is about both of them, is that you're really ignoring one of the major kingdoms in the body. And what the research has found, and this is what my father was a scientist that discovered, that it's not just that there's bacteria and fungi in the gut, but they actually work together and sometimes very destructively. So if you're ignoring this entire kingdom, you're really not balancing your total microbiome.
So let's go back to this idea, this fundamental idea that's really shown up in the last few years, at least at the population level. There's been researchers that have known about this, functional medicine doctors that have known that, hey, there's good bacteria, not all bacteria is bad. So same thing with fungi, is that there's some that are beneficial and there's some that are not beneficial, right?
Absolutely true.
What happens when they get out of balance? What are some of the implications that can happen in our body when we have too much of the bad and not enough of the good when it comes to fungi?
That's really a good point to try to clarify. If fungi is present, as you say, at low numbers, then in fact, it could be beneficial. What happens if it overgrows, that's where the problems start to happen. And you will start having gastrointestinal issues, you start to having inflammation, and you start to really be affected at different levels in your body, because the studies have been shown that in addition to bacteria, also fungi can affect our mood, for example. So that's why it's good to look at both of them and try to see, we need really to keep them at bay. Otherwise, as you were alluding to, they start causing us more and more issues and we are less and less well.
Yeah, and I think it's a misnomer. One of the things we always tell people is that, you know, everybody concentrates on, well, how do I get rid of the bad? It's really about keeping homeostasis with all the organisms, because take Canada, about half of us have Canada as a natural colonizer. It has actually a very good role to play when it's in check. The problem is, if things go off and Canada does come out of control, then it can have some negative effects. But Canada in and of itself can actually have a positive role. What are some of the roles that you've always told me?
One of the things, like, for example, when they are in the right proportion and imbalance, they can break some of the carbohydrates, complex carbohydrates, and to give simpler byproduct of these carbohydrates, which bacteria can use. And then bacteria can make it even simpler, which allow fungi to grow. So they basically work together to not only both of them grow well, but also they give products, they make these complex carbohydrates simpler for us as hosts to absorb. So we'll have better absorption. So in a way, we really need it at that level, because we are going to have better digestive system and better absorption of nutrients.
What's an example of a health condition, symptom, or disorder that's often linked to or connected to, let's say, the example of high amounts of candida, for example, or candida, as some people call
yes.
it?
I mean, the simplest one, which everybody will know, is the thrush, for example. When you have a little baby, they have in their mouth candida thrush. You have these white lesions there. Women have a lot of, when you have imbalance in candida, they have vaginal candidiasis, which is the
yeast
disease
infections.
Caused yeast infections. So these are one of the most important, sort of easy to understand.
Yeah, and a lot of times people with autoimmune disorders will have, again, the way to think about it is, if anything rocks your system and kind of suppresses your immune system, you're going to have an issue, right? And a lot of times people don't realize how on the verge, we love talking about this, is that we, in our gut testing, we see thousands and thousands of different samples. And we saw this cohort of women that had this very aggressive type of fungi called zygomycota growing out of control. So initially, when we said to dad, well, what do you think? He said, might be undiagnosed immune compromised situation. So like maybe cancer, HIV, but there was enough of a cluster that we went and looked a little deeper. And what we found was they were cutting out almost all their carbs, all their dairy. And because they're really impacting the prebiotic environment of the GI, it was allowing this very aggressive type of fungi to grow. Why? Because something on their system was probably, you know, compromised. So a lot of times it's got to do with, if your system's under a tremendous amount of stress, that's when we see fungi typically growing out of whack.
That's why a lot of the time I call fungal infections are the diseases of the immunocompromised. If your immunity is low, if you are taking antibiotics, if you are a transplant patient, for example, you are more likely to get the disease. If your immunity is really good, then you are fine. I tell you, the first time I did an experiment with mice to try to see how we can help them if they have fungal infections, when we treated them with an antifungal, they were all over the place. They were so happy. Even sometimes without treatment, because their immunity is intact, they were able to clear the disease. So fungi is a problem when it goes out of control.
So let's talk about antibiotics, because that's one of the things that you've been raising the alarm on, that we've been through this generation of overprescribing of antibiotics. There's antibiotics in our food systems that's there too. We've had podcasts in the past talking about the damage that antibiotics can cause in our bacterial microbiome. What kind of damage can antibiotics create when it comes to the microbiome?
What happens when you take an antibiotic? Somebody goes, they have an infection, they take an antibiotic. What you are doing is you are killing both good and bad bacteria. The bacteria that infect you, as well as the one which really is beneficial to you. So by doing this, you are giving the chance for fungi to grow. Like candida is under control because of these beneficial organisms. When they go, then it becomes out of control.
Get loose.
It get loose and start attacking.
It's like antibiotics are microbiome's best friend, because they get rid of the guys keeping them under control, and they allow the fungi to go bananas. That's why a lot of times, like Dad was saying, you'll see women have, you know, yeast infections, because all of a sudden the fungi is just not kept in check. So that can happen from like immunosystem or obviously antibiotics, something that's just destroying that colonized bacterial community.
And in the case of the yeast infections, any woman that's gone through it or any partner of theirs that knows that they might go in and they might get a recommendation for an antibiotic or antifungal in this case. But back in the day, it was also surprising that people would give them antibiotics. People used to get antibiotics for cold from their doctor, even if they wasn't related to bacteria that was there, even if it was viral. So there was a lot of misinformation. There was a lot of overprescribing. So they might, and the other component is a lot of people save their antibiotics or save their Z-Packs. They get some sort of infection, they're self-treating, and they'll just say, oh, I have a little bit of strep throat, I think, but they're not sure. I have a yeast infection. They'll just take the antibiotics on their own without checking with anybody. And then that can cause larger damage inside the system.
Well and we're seeing it now with Candida auris, which is the first fungal strain that's drug resistant. And Dad has widely talked about this, that the fact that a lot of it's probably tied to the food system.
You know, that's so very interesting because up till now, again, it's like not many people heard of the fungal community. Not many people heard of the resistance in fungi. We all know about the resistance in bacteria, but now we are starting to see that. So much so that this new fungus, as Afif mentioned, Candida auris, because it was isolated in the ears of a Japanese patient, is multi-drug resistant to all antifungals available in the market, which really is very unique. We did not see this up till now.
Incredible. So let's lay a little bit more groundwork. What are biofilms and what role do they play when it comes to the microbiome?
Let me first tell you what is a biofilm. And I'm sure Afif maybe can say a little bit more where people can understand it better than I described.
I think everybody's understanding you great right now.
So what happens, organisms, when they want to infect, the first thing they do is they stick to your tissue or they stick to your gut lining, okay? And then they start to produce this slimy material to protect themselves, as if you have jello, and inside the jello you have all these M&Ms or raisins. So the raisins are the fungi or the bacteria for that matter, and the jello which is covering them is what we call the matrix. Now, why this is important? Because once they do this, they become in a protected environment. Antibiotics cannot get rid of them, antifungal cannot get rid of them, and even our immune system cannot reach them. So our studies showed that in Crohn's disease patients, we found that bacteria and fungi, they come together and they start to form these biofilms. And we call them digestive plaque.
Okay. Right.
The nice, also interesting thing is other people now are starting to see these biofilms, not just in Crohn's patients, but in people with colorectal cancer or even diabetic wounds. So having a biofilm which made of pathogenic organism or bad microbes is not good news.
Right. So you have a bad fungi or bacteria, and we'll talk about how they develop these biofilms and how they get stronger, but essentially they have a force field around them.
Yes.
And they have a natural one. So naturally, it's a defense mechanism. It's a protection mechanism. But there's something happening today that's creating almost super fungi and super bugs. So what's happening today that's causing them to have these impenetrable shields from even our own immune system? What's causing, like, we know that we've heard the term of like antibiotic resistant bacteria, and that can often come from like hospital environments that are ultra, ultra, ultra clean.
Yes.
And using a lot of antibiotics, and then you can develop a superbug that's happening in the hospitals that can cause like C. difficile or other challenges. Is that the similar thing that's happening with our fungi?
With fungi, what happens is because we are using so many indwelling catheters, for example, so many plastics in our body, these fungi, they come and stick to the plastic and they start, which we say they adhere. And then once they adhere, they start to produce this and they become a big problem where it is responsible for up to 25% mortality rate in hospitals. So it is having a biofilm infection is not a good news. And really there is a great efforts. My team was involved in this and was funded by NIH to try to see how can we first understand how these biofilm form, and then can we find things that can get rid of them.
Understood. What are other things? Are there other things that cause these biofilms to form?
Yeah, and just as like some context too, people will oftentimes want to say, "Oh, I've never heard of biofilm." We say, "You actually have, like dental plaque. That's a biofilm." Right. And so when you're trying to get rid of that plaque on your teeth, it's not the biofilm plaque that's the issue. It's, as you said, it's this force field protecting these pathogenic organisms against your gums. Right. So what we're seeing is that sort of
the force field.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that matrix is really becoming more prominent all over the body. And a lot of it's to do with even in the agricultural system, there's a lot of pesticides, a lot of antifungals that are getting passed into the food system, which is
starting to have an effect. Could too much overusage of antifungals create a stronger biofilm on a fungi?
It may create an organism which is more resistant right. to antifungal, but then also it may rev their virulence factor. Like for example, if you have candida, let's say the simplest example, you have candida, it's in the gut, we kill the bacteria, we give it a chance to start to grow and where it stick to our gut lining, you know, the epithelial layer there. Once it sticks there, it starts to change its form. Like instead of becoming like baker's yeast, you know, like round, it becomes like thread, it becomes filament. And these filaments, they start to invade our gut lining and cause damage.
Yeah, you would literally see on the electron microscopy these filaments, which are basically like them latching in to the gut lining. Like that's one of the things when you talk about leaky gut, that's exactly what's happening. You will actually see in this 5000X electron microscopy, yeah. organisms going through the gut lining.
And really, it does not have, I gave it an example at the beginning of biofilms, they stick to catheters, but also they stick to our tissues, like for example, the gut lining. Or in certain extreme cases where candida go through the gut and start invading the kidney, for example, if you look at the kidney, you find all these white patches on it, which are biofilms there, forming in the tissue. So it does not have to be an inanimate object. It really can grow also in our tissue and start causing problems.
So what's the repercussions of all these biofilms and their increasing amount in our bodies worldwide? What's the repercussions of it in our own body and our own health?
I mean, repercussion is if you don't control them, they will start, as I said, maybe breaking down our gut lining and start causing systemic infection. That's why it's very important to control them. Now, there is something which I want to say also, but there are some good biofilms. Not all of them are bad.
Right. There's some that are in our mouth that are also good.
Yes.
And like that, there's some in our gut that are also good.
Yes, because these are formed by the beneficial microbes. And this is good because in a way, these biofilms try to protect our lining, gut lining. So in cases, if these pathogenic organisms, the bad ones, that they come together, then we have a problem and we need to get rid of them.
The other thing they'll do is biofilms will actually inhibit nutrient absorption because they're literally lining the gut. And they do two things. One, they act as a physical barrier to nutrients going through the GI lining, but also these organisms actually scavenge nutrients. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword when it comes to nutrient
absorption.
Like
a parasite that's stealing your
Yeah, literally. So that's why as much as possible, you just want to be able to eradicate those pathogenic biofilms.
What did the understanding of biofilms, how has that more broadened the understanding of how to treat people's health? So now that we know that biofilms are more prevalent and that more people are facing them and that there's good and bad ones, once we start to understand that, how can we begin to approach gut health in a different way?
So, let me take a step back. When he did his big clinical trial on Crohn's patients in 2016, and he really found that bacteria and fungi were causing these biofilms that for Crohn's patients was causing just these severe side effects, people started asking very naturally, well, is there a probiotic you recommend? Is there an antifungal you recommend? How do I get a control of this? And when we looked in the market, no one had tried to address not just the dual role of bacteria and fungi, but biofilms specifically. So you're throwing all these probiotics in, but like that said, if you have a strong biofilm, even antibiotics are not able to break that down. So we said, you know, really, if you're going to address this, you need to break down that biofilm matrix. And so that's what we thought was really the approach to taking that holistic total approach to gut health was you have to really inhibit these specific organisms causing that biofilm matrix.
And what we did to reach that goal is we did what you call correlation analysis. We tried to look at what organisms can inhibit the bad bugs like E. coli, Serratia marcescens, and Candida. And what organisms can play with them very well. And based on this, we found a subset of probiotic strains, which is both bacteria and fungus, that when you put them together, as well as you add an enzyme which breaks down some of this matrix or some of, as you say, protective layer, we were able to show that using this, we destroyed the biofilm, both in vitro. Also, we showed it in the gut of animals where you treated with these strains and the enzyme, it becomes completely cleared. And this work, we published it in April of this year.
Incredible. So we're going to talk more about like the practical implications of it, but I want to dive a little bit deeper into the microbiome. So I've read that you guys said it can take months or years to shift your gut bacteria in a significant way, but you can alter your gut fungi profile for better or for worse in just 24 hours. Tell us more about that.
So this really based on a study by a professor called Hoffman. He published a paper and he put people on diets and tried to see how fast you can change the microbiome, both the bacteria and the fungus.
The fungal community.
But he also looked at the bacterial community as well.
Right.
And what he found that the microbiome, the fungal components, can change very fast. And that's why he called it short-term diet. You can change it by short-term diet. When he looked at the bacteria, it took forever to try to change, and that's why he said it, to try to change it, you need long-term diet. That's why our ability to change the microbiome quickly is beneficial to us, which will help us rebalance the gut.
Why do you think, just zooming out big picture, you know, they have this harmonious relationship where our bacteria and our fungi play together to keep things in harmony for their own benefit and then our benefit too. But why do you think it's so easy? Like, what's the purpose inside the body to be able to modify our microbiome, our fungi community so quickly? Like, why are they so susceptible to immediate dietary changes? What's the benefit to that?
The benefit to them is that they can respond very fast. Like, it is the fungus is very smart. Why? Because you give them food, they can change very, very quickly their metabolism and they use it faster. Whereas with the bacteria, it takes longer to do that.
And do they have different roles and duties? Like, coming back to the basics of it, are there things that our fungi are doing in our body that we can isolate that's different than our bacteria are doing?
Oh, sure. There are, as I mentioned, one example which we said, like, fungi can break the complex carb, but bacteria can break the simpler one. Okay. Also, if you have a good, we always talk about the bad one, the candida, but if you have Saccharomyces boulardii, for example, or Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the baker's yeast, what we found is that in the gut, it really antagonizes the bad bugs. So it secretes antifungals, which can kill candida. So it can keep it under control. That's why for our gut, we need more Saccharomyces and less candida, relatively speaking.
Yeah, sometimes when people go to India or Mexico or another country where they're not used to like the bacteria, the fungi that's there, they get, you know, in India, they call it deli belly.
Yes.
Right, where they get diarrhea. And often one treatment for that a lot of functional medicine doctors have, in addition to personalizing it for what the person's going through, is they'll give them Saccharomyces boulardii, this yeast-eating, non-colonizing bacteria, to help them break down the fungi that they picked up that they weren't used to address that.
I think this is very smart because there are even studies to show that Saccharomyces boulardii can inhibit antibiotic-associated diarrhea, for example, or diarrhea which could be, you give somebody antibiotic and then guess what? We have a lot of candida overgrowth, which will then stimulate release of water, potassium, and calcium. Having Saccharomyces boulardii will stop that because it will control candida and then you really recover. So this is absolutely true and helpful, as you said, in deli belly.
Deli belly. Or in Mexico, sometimes they refer to it as Montezuma's revenge.
Yes.
I don't know if any of this is politically correct or not. I'm just using the terms that people use for it. So, and I've recommended to a few friends before with great results. So let's come back to diet and the role that our diet plays. We talked about how our diet can impact our fungi in a short period of time. Let's talk about the things that can have maybe some of the bad fungi grow, or fungi. Do you have a preference on people, if people say fungi or fungi?
It's the same. It just depends on the accent.
Yes. So one of the things that my people like my business partner, Dr. Mark Hyman, talks about, they're big advocates for cutting down sugar inside the diet.
Yes.
Right? So we often hear that, especially when it comes to Candida or Candida, that one of the things that can flourish bad levels of yeast in the body is sugar. Is that true?
Absolutely.
So what's happening when we have sugar or high amounts of sugar in our diet, added sugar, and why do the yeast in our body and the fungi like it so much?
First of all, it's easier for them to assimilate and grow, you know. But definitely, if you have sugar, high levels of it, you are sure to increase your growth of candida in your gut. So it's like we call it sugar-loving microbe because of this, you know. Now, there are other things which could... I would say this is the number one maybe factor in the diet that will encourage the most growth of candida. But there are other stuff which can also affect it. For example, if you have processed food, sweeteners, you know, we actually did a study where we not only looked at candida, but when we had artificial sweeteners, we fed the mice that, and guess what? We were able to see that there is a shift in bacteria, protobacteria, which is a pro-inflammatory organism. It's a
so
red
increased
flag.
Sugar in the diet of these mice created more inflammation in the body.
It definitely created more inflammation. And that's why really one of the bad stuff is artificial sweeteners, for example, as well as sugars. And apart from that, you know, other factors, of course, these are the main ones. But if you have red meat, for example, it also encourages the imbalance or what we call dysbiosis on the microbial flora.
Now, what's the mechanism in red meat? Because it's a time where, you know, there's a lot of debate and discussion on nutrition. So what's the mechanism or what's happening with red meat specifically that is causing, that is being linked to or correlated to disruption in the microbiome?
I think,
and does it distinguish between grass-fed or not grass-fed?
I mean, look, the major issue with the red meat is the high fat content, a lot of high fat content, which really encourages the growth of microorganisms in our gut that are bile tolerant. They love the bile tolerance, so they grow very well in the presence of high fat from the meat, and that will lead to the growth of microbes like that, which are pro-inflammatory, which in other words, they cause inflammation. Whereas if you try and use, let's say you want proteins, take proteins from fish, for example, is not gonna do the same. And that's really the main thing with respect to the microbiome and the high-fat diet. And
so that's animal meat that we're talking about.
Yes.
What about high-fat diet from vegetable sources?
You know, a study was done where it showed high-fat diet from vegetables do not encourage the growth of these bile-loving organisms, which are inflammatory, compared to the high-fat diet. So this was published, a study where it shows basically if you take high fat from plant source is not bad at all.
We just recently had, I don't know if you guys are connected with him, but Kiran Krishnan from Microbiome Labs. And one of the things he talked about is that he had just completed a study that they're going to be publishing at some point in time about the saturated fat in coconut oil.
Yes.
And how even though we were told like coconut oil is great, great, there's a lot of benefits for it, he saw some early signs that it could be leading to endotoxemia in the body because large amounts of saturated fat could be causing disruption, which could create more intestinal permeability. Any thoughts or comments on that inside the space? Or
I really think that's one of the things which we advocate, that you should have monounsaturated or polyunsaturated. If you take such high saturated fatty acids is not good, because definitely it can affect the balance of the microbiota.
So one follow-up question that's there is that we see now a growth in the movement of carnivore diet, right? And that's people who, for my podcast listeners who are not familiar, these are individuals who are just literally getting rid of all vegetables, all fruits, and eating, you know, 95% or more of their diet is coming from meat. And, you know, I know some individuals that are on it, and often these people found their way to the carnivore diet because of severe gut dysbiosis. They were having severe bloating, They've tried a lot of different sort of repair processes or gut things, but they continue to react to the carbohydrates in vegetable foods and other things like that. So they've ultimately found their way to a very high protein, high fat diet. And anecdotally, it seems that some people are getting some benefit from it. That's there. Just anecdotally, you know, I'm sure we need some studies on it. Any thoughts as to why in the short term some people might be getting benefits from things like the carnivore diet?
Sometimes if you just eat a lot of vegetables, fibers, and this sort of thing, definitely it will cause bloating. So that's why, in a way, if you want to shift your diet, you should start really slowly increasing the fiber. Now, to me, I am not an advocate of going all meat, okay? Or for that matter, all carbohydrate. I think our body requires carbs, requires proteins, requires fat. So the secret is which one you want to select, the right ones. If you select the right ones, then you are gonna nourish your gut microbiome, both bacteria and fungi, and this is going to have a good effect in your body.
Yeah, one example I'll give, we were helping a former UFC fighter who was having, you know, cut out of marble, severe digestive issues, and we said, "Are you, you know, talk to us about your vegetable, you know, plant-based part of your diet." "Oh, no, no. Every time I start going heavy with that, I start having serious digestive issues. I can't do it. You know, I'm doing a lot of keto." And what we finally got him to understand was, no, your body needs time to shift, right? So it likely will feel uncomfortable when you're starting to really, especially when you go heavy. And the problem is a lot of people go extremes one way or the other. If they're going from, you know, carnivore diet and all of a sudden they're going plant-based, it's completely plant-based. Going back to those women I was telling you with the zygomycota, they were almost completely cutting out carbs, dairy. And the reality is it's a boring answer, but it's all about sort of middle path, right? Like you just got to be reasonable. A lot of these things, it's all moderation. And again, going back to it, a lot of people will assume they're having a bad reactions to more plant-based diet. They're just not giving their system long enough to get used to it. And they really have to start like very minimally and build out over a couple months.
But there could be some cases in the instance of like, a lot of people come to our clinic, functional medicine doctor's office, you know, they might be dealing with something like SIBO. Small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, where they are genuinely having a reaction
totally different
to certain types of foods.
The same we have. You have SIBO and SIFO, which is small intestinal fungal overgrowth.
Right.
I think one way, I mean, clearly, this is very complex area. You cannot just say, okay, as Afif said, you'll go in one way, not the other. I think moderation is the way. Also, you need to look at other lifestyles. You know, like for example, we had a lady in our trial. She had complete dysbiosis. We collect questionnaire from her what she eats. She eats perfect, like from our point of view. Then when we looked at the questionnaire more metadata, what we found, she is highly stressed, very stressed, extreme stress she ticked. So you need to address those issues in addition to your diet.
Food is only one piece of the puzzle.
It's one piece of the puzzle.
Which I couldn't agree more with. So when it comes to the microbiome and really putting the highlight on how important these fungi are, what are some foods? You were talking earlier about somebody who was eating perfectly, but also thought they were removing foods that were not good for them, but that might have unintended consequences that are there. So foods that traditionally sometimes get a bad rap, again, there's personalization that's there, but carbs, dairy products, soy, how sometimes this might explain why some people get benefits from those foods. What's the relationship of those foods and how they could have a positive impact on the microbiome?
You see, when we say carbs, it's really a very big category.
Right. So it could mean anything from like highly processed things to a piece of broccoli.
And even you have some digestible carbs and indigestible carbs. Yes. In other words, some, let's say the simple sugars stuff, they are digestible. You eat them, they break down in your intestine and they change maybe to give you energy and some, help. The other type of diet which is going to help your gut is the indigestible, like resistant starch, like fiber, Okay. Yeah. Because these are not broken down in our intestine. They go all the way to the colon. And then in the colon, who is happy? The microbes. The microbes are there and they start to break it down. And by breaking it down, especially the beneficial organism doing that, they are producing good metabolites like short-chain fatty acids.
And just for context, can you give our listeners an example of something that is in that category of food that's in the indigestible carbs? Yes. That our gut bacteria and our fungi love.
Like, for example, bananas. If you take bananas, which is unripened, don't take it away till it becomes all dotted black in the outside.
You know? Unripened, you want us to take the green better, bananas?
Not quite.
But not fully brown.
Not fully brown. Oh, yeah, okay. So that's one thing. Oats, for example, is very good. You have lentils, they have also good stuff like that. So there are a lot of categories which the people, sweet potatoes, for example, is good also.
Right.
Yeah.
So these foods, they're important because why? When they make it down to our colon and the bacteria engage with them and the fungi, what benefit do they give to us?
What benefit is that when they take them, basically they use them as a food source because our body did not break them, they can break them. Once they break them, they start to produce small molecules we call metabolites, okay? Such as short-chain fatty acids, like for example, one of them, butyrate. Okay, these are small compounds that when they are taken in the blood, they will really help us with respect to the inflammation, with respect to gut brain access, for example. It improves this sort of thing. So this is the benefit. The benefit is you are going to help the beneficial bacteria to grow and give you byproducts which are going to be good for our health.
Yeah, and I think that's really, when you look at that, it's about making the conversation more broad than just what probiotic strains are in my GI, what bad strains are. And it's really about building the ecosystem in the gut through building a very probiotic-friendly environment. You do that through prebiotic-friendly foods, that sort of thing. So it's not so much always about optimizing to these specific strains. It's about creating almost like topsoil for your gut.
How much does our genetic background, you know, we've talked about how there's a new term out, like don't eat like a Paleolithic ancestor, eat like your great grandfather or grandmother, because you're going to share similar gut microbiome. Yeah. So what was their diet like? Where were they from? What's their country of origin? If your family isn't from the equator or from, you know, India or other countries that had traditionally maybe a lot more coconut, maybe you should think twice about having a lot of coconut inside your diet. So when it comes to the microbiome, the fungi, how much does our genetic lineage play a role or not play a role?
I think if you look at it maybe a little bit bigger picture, like Crohn's disease, for example. Crohn's disease, it's the genetics, it's the immune dysregulation, as well as the microbiome. So genetics definitely play some role, okay? If your genetic affecting your immunity, then definitely it's going to be in favor of fungus. Okay? If you have some autoimmune disease, for example, which is caused by genes, you know, whatever you inherited from your parents.
Or the expression of those genes, the epigenetics of those genes.
Definitely, if they are exactly, the expression is overexpressed, for example, then you may have these sort of autoimmune disease. And like, for example, we've been looking at psoriasis, like which is nothing to do with the gut, but psoriasis in the skin. And we are finding that because of this autoimmune disease, we are seeing both a change in the microbiome in bacteria as well as in fungus. So definitely genetics could maybe not cause it, but could be a contributing factor for fungi to increase.
And do you see variation genetically based on fungi? You know, we already talked about how like fungi is very quickly influenced.
Yeah.
Within 24 hours, you know, your diet can influence your fungi. But do you see people from different parts of the world have different makeup of their fungi?
You know, this is a very good question. I tell you, my Center for Medical Mycology, which I do a lot of clinical trials for companies to evaluate their antifungals, we acted as a global, basically, lab for samples coming from all over the world. And when you look at it, fungal samples, like, for example, people who have nail infections. We got samples from India, we got samples from Europe, we, of course, from the US. And you find, and sometimes we got samples from Japan. You will find some differences. Like in certain places, like for example, in India, I know there is Candida tropicalis is very high. The incidence of that is very high in there. When you look in the US, the number one cause is Candida albicans. So followed by Candida glabrata, you know, so there are some variation, but not huge variation, I would say.
Got it. So everybody always brings us back to, so what do we do about it, right? So I'd love to talk about both solutions that you guys have been working on because, you know, I'll get into why. Both solutions you guys have, but also coming back to diet, if we really want to take care of the fungi community and keep it in check,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Not have it completely disappear because that's bad, but not have too much overgrowth because that's bad in terms of the outcomes that are there. We already talked about sugar as being one of the number one things that can have the bad fungi grow. What are the things that we can do and that we can focus on that we all have control over that can create that healthy relationship of fungi and bacteria in our body? What should we be eating more of?
Very good question. I think what we should be eating more whole food, obviously. We need to have protein sources from plants, for example, or if you want from animals, a chicken or fish, for example, is also a good source. You need to have fibers because, again, remember, when they are together, bacteria and fungi, we need to help beneficial bacteria to keep Candida under control. So having fiber-resistant starch is going to help it, you know. In addition, there are other things which you can take. Like, for example, we know Candida is associated with inflammation. So if you take ginger, for example, is good. Turmeric is very good. Garlic is great. In fact, I published maybe 3 years in the effect of garlic, three articles, in the effect of garlic on the Candida. So all of this can help very much. If you are having some issues, having a probiotic that has both, that has, for example, Saccharomyces boulardii, as I mentioned, will be also helpful. Now, with respect to Candida, something which have been shown in literature, if you have some deficiency in vitamins A, B, and C, so it's good to have food that have these vitamins as well, or multivitamin, for example.
And what role do those vitamins play when it comes to Candida, for example? So you have an overgrowth of yeast. How is our increasing those things like vitamin C play a role in keeping that in check?
What happens, the studies showed that if you are deficient in vitamin C, Candida can grow well. So in a way, by providing these vitamins, you are creating an environment which does not support the growth of Candida in this way.
Understood. It all seems like such a straightforward advice for more people. And yet we still are dealing with such an epidemic of Candida and fungal overgrowth.
Yeah. And the numbers don't lie. Right. And so the example I love to give is we've all been stuck in traffic behind the guy on the carbon fiber bike. He's got the Lycra suit, the unbelievable helmet, and he's about 80 pounds overweight. And you're like, dude, you don't need that bike. Lose some weight, you'll just be a little more aerodynamic. When we look at our gut tests, who take it, and we get people like, because when people take our gut test, they can also talk to a nutritionist.
Right, this is an at-home test that people can do.
Right, right. And so people are looking for a silver bullet. They're looking, like you were asking earlier about grass-fed beef, and they're asking about these very specific A1, A2, like very specific nuances. And then 50% of people who take our test eat fast food at least once a week. So a lot of times what we find is like people are not, you know, blocking and tackling on the basics before getting into the nuance of these, like, you know what I mean? Very specific things.
Highly personalized.
Yeah. Like very optimized, like Olympian type diet changes, you know, there. And it's like anything. It's a lot of times, you know, people will ask us, well, should I be taking this probiotic? Or should I be? And we're saying, don't even worry about supplements till you get your diet in check.
Step one,
these are dietary supplements. Your diet should be driving the bus. But,
Also, as we mentioned before, lifestyle. You need to sleep better. Try to sleep better. Try to exercise.
Instead of trying to get your diet like 2% better.
Yes.
How's your sleep? Is it happening consistently?
Yeah, stress.
Because let's just talk about that for a second. how does sleep have an impact when it comes to either a microbiome or a mycobiome, for example?
You know, I mean, in a way, sleep, when you are not sleeping well, you are going to affect the brain, you know, your chemicals in your brain and this sort of thing. And if there is some imbalance in your metabolism, this is have been shown to affect the gut.
So the gut-brain connection.
Gut-brain connection, and it's bidirectional. So if you have an issue, you are not sleeping well, you are so exhausted, your function is not doing well, you are going to have imbalance in your gut. And that when you have this imbalance, you are going to have the gastrointestinal issues. Mm-hmm. And it's the other way. If you have imbalance in your gut, what it showed that you can change some chemicals in the brain, like serotonin, for example, which again affect your mood. Okay, so it's really a very sensitive balance you need to try to adjust. But it is not that difficult if you have the will and you select your food. You try to change slowly with respect to your exercise, with respect to your sleep, your stress. You know, go out, hike, do some meditation. I give you a laugh. I started, you know, for somebody like who come from Lebanon to start doing yoga, this is something unbelievable. Mm-hmm. My mom wouldn't like that, I'm sure. But guess what? It is great.
And it works.
It works, it relaxes you, and then it helps you along the way. So
when you first came to this country and you started doing your research in this space, it was really under the umbrella of infectious disease.
Yes.
To get the funding that you needed.
Yes.
When did you realize that there were implications in your research that were at the sort of consumer level? When did that aha moment come that like, whoa, like people can actually do something about this and that can improve their health?
You know, this was about maybe 10 years ago now, since we started, because I used to go to these meetings, you know, scientific meeting, American Society for Microbiology, and I sit and listen to people and they're talking about bacteria. And then I said, you know, it must be fungi is important. And finally, when I first came to the US, I went to a meeting, it's called Candida and Candidiasis. Mm-hmm. So obviously the organism and the disease that caused by Candida. And there was one physicians talking about, we really need to look at the yeast syndrome. You know, this, like a lot of the time he said everything happens is because of yeast, you know, which is really overblown. It's not true. There are certain things which happens which are caused by yeast, but nobody listened at that time. But
people weren't paying attention back then.
Paying attention at all. And then when I started looking into the fungus and I started to see that by changing, for example, in our first study with HIV-infected patients, by seeing that there is one organism, its presence could affect the candida, which is the bad one, I thought, oh, there may be some ways where we can manipulate this. And the whole thing coalesced when we looked at Crohn's disease patients. And
that's when it really became apparent.
That became clear that, oh my goodness, we really can do something about that.
So Afif, you know, you are your dad's son and you are just living your life, going about it, right? Hanging out with friends, going to school. At one point in time, were you aware of your dad, like really like this microbiome? And then when did that turn into, okay, my dad is now showing through his research, this is important. Pharmaceuticals tend to only pay attention to things that they can patent, but people still need solutions for it. Take us through that journey.
Yeah, so not shockingly, I hear a lot from my dad, oh, I published this really exciting paper. I'm like, oh, that's awesome, right? Like, but it's typically like very interesting in the scientific community, right? Or the academic community, right? Kind of ivory tower-ish. So in 2016, he published his paper on Crohn's and he's saying, oh, this is a big paper. I'm like, that's awesome. And then literally Case Western School of Medicine got thousands of people reaching out, trying to get a hold of him. And it was people from around the world who had someone dealing with Crohn's. And they were saying like, how can I figure this out? Like and one woman in particular, Forbes covered this. She wrote a letter and it was like upsetting to read it. And it was basically like, she had two sons that had Crohn's. She had trekked all over Europe trying to find a solution. And she was begging my dad, could you test their guts? And his lab was not set up for that. His lab is set up for like heavy duty NIH funded clinical trials. And I said to him, like, this is insane. Like, you're doing this type of research and this poor woman can't access it. Like, that does not make sense. And when we looked in the market, we said, you know, no one is talking about this dual role of bacteria and fungi. So we launched Biome. And the whole point was just to basically take out of the ivory tower what he was doing. And to this day, the testing we do is the exact testing he's been doing for NIH.
And it's not just the testing, but it's also the solutions for it. So it's having, everybody's talking about what probiotic to take, but being one of the first companies or the first company that's taking fungi and probiotic in the right relationship to have the most bang.
Yeah, so when we look, these people are asking specifically, like, how can I address biofilms in the gut? Like, I read your research, and we look at me, there's no one who's addressed this, like, with any evidence, right? So when we created Biome, and we specifically created it to break down this matrix of the biofilm. So using, as Dad said, correlation analysis, we found, what are these organisms creating in the biofilm? What probiotic organisms break down those organisms in the biofilm? And if you could do that, you break down, like you said, that the jello, and you can really then get to the pathogenic guys underneath that force field.
And you know, it was really amazing how many people contacted me and start to say, can you help us? What's this? And then I told Afif, you know, I was working in HIV area. And, you know, the HIV and AIDS community are very, very close, and they are very supportive, and passionate. They push for research and passionate, you know, to do more and more research to help them. Lo and behold, I realized that there are so many people in the U.S. that and worldwide, in fact, that they have got issues. So it became to me, I said, you know, this is really important area to try to address and try to do something about it. And that's what keeps us excited, because we believe that what we are doing is going to help them. And that makes me happy, because as a professor, not always you can have your basic research translated. But this
right,
one,
often
anyway,
it's just sitting there.
It says, yeah.
In the community, in more discussion, and maybe like 30 years later, it turns into something.
Yeah. Well, and even like we had commercialized products mainly in oral care, basically killing germs, right? And we'd sold products all over the place. And, you know, I used to joke with Dad, like, there's no like mouthwash survivors, advocates of the world groups. Like, it's not a thing, right? When you look in the GI, like, whether it's Crohn's, whether it's all sorts of issues, people are passionately into this subject, because it just shocked us when you really look, like, everybody seems to, or if they don't, someone they know deals with GI issues, and it's very, very passionate community.
So one of the articles that's on your website, Dr. G, is basically, you know, I forgot the title, but it's like, what does Dr. G eat, or what does a researcher eat, right? When you started digging into this space and you started to understand the importance of that symbiotic relationship between the fungi and the bacteria, can you remember of any sort of early changes you were making in your own lifestyle, saying, okay, maybe I should change what I'm doing now?
You know, I always like to eat fruits and vegetables, because I am, you know, from a temperate climate, and we have all these fruits and vegetables there, so I am used to it. But I started to eat more maybe celery, so I wanted a little bit more fiber, which I didn't eat before. I love fish, but I started now to eat more of it than before. So I started to change subtly things, not to have too much steak. I mean, the U.S., the steak is great, but I don't think it's great for my microbiome. So even if I go and have some, I make sure I don't have too much. As Afif said, moderation.
Right. And so, I guess also from your culture, like Lebanese, there'll be like a lot of lamb.
Of course, a lot of lamb, a lot of hummus, you know, like all this tabbouleh, which is a lot of cracked wheat, cucumber, tomatoes, and this sort of things. They are all good type of food, basically, that is going to support your gut microbiome, both bacteria and fungi.
And Afif, how about for yourself? You know, on a practical level, when you look at all this stuff, were there things that you started modifying differently in your approach when it came to trying to support the fungi?
Yeah, so definitely being more aggressive about being focused on plant-based diet, and then definitely cutting out red meat. Like, that's the one that when you look at sort of the overwhelming evidence, not just in the microbiome, but just overall, that like plant-based, it's like Michael Pollan's like, eat plenty of plants, some meat, not a lot type approach. So I've become a lot more conscious because, you know, to be honest, a lot of our consumers are very passionate and they're trying to make these adjustments. So, you know, for us, it became a lot more personal about making these adjustments ourselves. But it's still, listen, it's still a work in progress. Like other things, like, you know, we talk about the stress, like that's something that we definitely both probably need to work on, you know? So it's always being multifactorial. There's always things that can be optimized,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. You know, that's the other thing that I always exercise, but now I really make it every morning I wake up, I do the elliptical, and I do stretches because of the yoga. I make you laugh. I used to watch the news. Now I don't watch the news. I watch I Love Lucy or something very, very comedy type, something relaxing. Otherwise, you know, you start the day stressed out. So it's better. Just relax. Try to do your exercise. Don't kill yourself. But that's really will work very well. Also, I start to change at work. I don't use now elevators. I go up the stairs. So it's quite good.
How do environmental factors or the products that we use affect beneficially or positively the microbiome? We hear a lot of people coming on the podcast before, and we had this wave, especially in like the 80s and the early 90s, of like antibacterial, kill everything, you know, overdo this, hand sanitizer everywhere.
I think this is really not a good way to go. I tell you why, because we have a live example which happened in the Netherlands, where they use a lot of antifungals to spray plants. And guess what happens?
And why specifically in the Netherlands? Just for context.
That's where the first paper came out, because it seems, especially with tulip and this sort of thing, they use so much.
Oh, for the flowers. To protect them.
They use a huge amount of antifungals. And lo and behold, they started to see infection caused by Aspergillus, one of the fungi, which is mold, basically. And next step, patients start to be to have disease with Aspergillus, and then when they did DNA typing, they found the same strains that were in the tulip, for example, they were infecting this patient. So that's why I really think we don't need to kill everything as far as microorganisms are concerned, because in a way we are encouraging the resistance, both bacteria and fungus, and also it's no doubt some of these chemicals will also affect us if we have a lot of, for example, meat, which where the cows have been given a huge amount of antibiotics, you know. All of this affect our health. So from my point of view, I think it's if you can get organic as much as possible, will be helpful. I know it's a challenge sometimes because it's not cheap, but try to select better choices than things which really are environmental.
And reducing household cleaners and the chemicals that we're being exposed to, those things also wreak havoc on our...
No doubt about it. That's why there is a study where people who live in farms where they don't use all of these, guess what? Their children don't have as much allergy as people who live in the city with all Purell always in their hand. Yeah. So definitely organisms are not our enemy. In a way, I advocate that let people play in the dirt a little bit, because that's good, because our body and their immune system will get trained to face these organisms if they come and infect you.
Well, and even households that have pets are a lot more healthy just because the animals coming in and out of the house. Like this idea of, again, it comes back to this, and a lot of it's a marketing message. It's very simple to explain. Bad germs, get rid of them. Good germs, encourage them, right? And it's really, these all live in an ecosystem. So something will give if you're getting rid of one community, right? So when you're killing all these bad organisms, something's going to be off, right? And you're seeing it.
So I want to give a plug to Biome and some of the stuff that you guys are up to, because it's very rare that the researchers' work directly influences like immediately so closely the expression of products. A lot of products that are out there are done on sort of what I would call like borrowed research or associative research. So especially when it comes to probiotics, you'll find a lot of strains that are on the market that are used specifically for, maybe they're recommending it for a general probiotic, but it's only treated for, it's only studied for diarrhea, right, and yeah, playing an influence there, or only specifically in like Crohn's patients. So how did you guys go about in terms of selecting what products are beneficial to most people? How did you go about selecting the strains and the types of things that go into the bacteria and the fungi and the products that you have at Biome?
Yeah, so our generation one, because our generation two is coming down the pipeline, which I think you'll get a kick out of. But generation one was literally looking at what are these pathogenic organisms. And let me take a step back. A lot of products are developed just the way you said. They find either an interesting ingredient and maybe there's a small clinical trial and they sort of cobble it together in a formula and they market it, right? We worked backwards. We said, okay, what are we trying to address? We think biofilms need to be broken down. Okay, what are in those biofilms, these pathogenic organisms? How do we inhibit those specific organisms? So then what we then did was sourced strains in the US that would actually inhibit those organisms plus the digestive enzyme, and that became our biome formula. So then we did clinical trials, but we started from a very targeted formulation based on what he had seen in these Crohn's clinical trials. So that's how we...
That's exactly. I mean, that's how science really led us. The first thing is we looked at Crohn's disease patients. We found what is there. Then we knew that because we compared the family members with Crohn's versus their same people who are living in the same, like brothers or sisters that don't have Crohn's. And we compared the two, and we knew that these organisms in the Crohn's disease patients that cause issue. So the first thing we identified what is there. And then we knew what they are doing because clearly they have gastrointestinal issues. So the third step is, okay, how can we try to prevent them? And that's where we did the correlation analysis and we did targeted really research to try to inhibit E. coli, which is known to be pathogen, Serratia marcescens, also another bacteria which is known to cause infection, and of course Candida, which is really the number one pathogen as far as fungi is concerned. So when we did that and we said, okay, they are these organisms, they come together, what do they do? And when we put them together, we had strains from our collection. We have thousands of strains of clinical isolates, and we put them together, and lo and behold, they made biofilms. And then when they make biofilms, we said, okay, not only they are there, they are making this biofilm which protected them. So our now aim or objective is to try to break these biofilms. And that's how we selected these strains as well as added the enzyme, because we thought this also will give a helping hand for the strains. And that's how we came out with Biome.
So, you know, you both have like a biotech link and a background and a connection. Sometimes pharmaceutical companies get a really bad rap because it feels like they're only in it to make money. They're not necessarily like in the good graces of the public right now, especially with everything that's happening with like the opioid crisis. The viewpoint is negative. But pharmaceutical companies have also created some life-saving drugs that we wouldn't be here. One of the conversations that comes up is that they don't pay attention to a lot of these solutions because there's not a patent or something that they can own there. But you guys have a link into it. Do you see the pharmaceutical companies starting to pay attention a little bit more? Are they looking for these solutions that are out there?
You know, this is so interesting. Last week, I was at ID Week, Infectious Disease Week, where everybody in infectious disease, they come together, and pharmaceutical companies were there. And I knew some of them. I helped them to develop their drugs. So we were talking. They say, hey, Mahmoud, what are you up to? I say, well, I am doing now microbiome, my specialty. And it's amazing. I'm not going to mention names of the companies, but big pharma. They say, you know, we are watching. We want to come in, but we really don't know quite yet. It's like the .com. You know, when it was the dot-com started.
We know the internet's going to be big.
It's big, but they don't have. But I told Afif, you know, Afif, I think this is going to be a very hot area because people are going to come in because they know they are starting to see that these non-therapeutic approaches or non-pharmaceutical approaches is helping people. So I think they will come in.
And they are already coming in one aspect. And to your point, like pharma gets generally a very bad rap. But one of the things you're seeing the Pfizers of the world and how they're entering the market a lot of times is they're acquiring brands, right? And what we've seen, because we do actually supply other products with microbiome testing, microbiome ingredients, what we've seen is that with the entry of the pharma companies into the space, the quality levels on manufacturing supply chain have gone through the roof. So what you would have gotten in a bottle 10 years ago, it's not even comparable to the standard now. And that's because pharma came in and really everybody's starting to apply pharma level quality,
you know, manufacturing standards, exactly, approaches, right. Sources, yeah. Of ingredients, because still dietary supplements overall, exactly. Are unregulated.
Exactly.
Totally.
And you know what's so interesting? Even at the science side, the National Institute of Health now putting what you call RFA, request for applications, for people to put grants to study probiotics, because they want to know how useful are these? Are they effective? So this is good news, because they are pouring money into this area of research, which definitely gonna lead to new understanding and better management of this area, where we are gonna end up with good products. It's similar to, as you said, with so many products that pharmaceutical companies produced before. I think this is where it's going now.
Yeah, we're also seeing in the space, if we had Dr. Roland Griffiths, who's a researcher in the space of psilocybin and its impact on depression or end of life depression, or people who have severe addiction. Mm-hmm. So he's at Johns Hopkins and he's doing a lot of research on how magic mushroom psilocybin can severely impact and curb addiction when it comes to smoking cessation, which is one of the hardest addictions to break. They've seen some incredible things that are there. And he's working with pharmaceutical companies to see, can we turn this into something that can be applied to individuals?
You said this earlier, and one of the biggest challenges is going to be pharma companies are going to have a hard time getting into the space without knowing that they have something that's protectable, because these guys pour, just the way the regulations are set up with FDA, it takes hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more, to get a drug through approvals. So these guys are only going to invest in that if they know they have protection. And that's a double-edged sword, right? They bring all this innovation, R&D efforts, but you know, it also builds a moat where all of a sudden things that were generally accessible, maybe in a supplement context, or obviously psilocybin, not so much a supplement context, but you know, all of a sudden you're going to have a lot of regulations, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. So you're seeing it, for example, in fecal transplants, right? So that obviously is basically cataclysmic changing situation with C. diff, mm-hmm. and these things, but the regulations haven't been there. So guess what? Over the summer, you see a couple clinical trials where people die, right? Mm-hmm. Because the quality is not consistent. And that is only going to prompt, you know, pharma making the case that you need us doing this because of the quality, because of safety. And again, that's a double-edged sword, because all of a sudden something that was generally available, maybe at a lower cost, probably will have prices hike up, but that's the trade-off, right?
And potentially side effects in the implementation. Totally. Sure. You know, sure. I think it's like 80%, 85% of pharmaceuticals come from plant compounds. And of course, yes, they're made at a much higher dosages and concentrations or isolations, yeah, that are there. Yeah. And sometimes there's side effects. And we all are just trying to make the best decision we can.
Exactly.
There's life-changing and saving drugs that are out there.
But that's where the physician comes in. Like, right, you see in the opioid crisis, like a lot of, there's something, some crazy stat, like 85% of pain prescriptions where an opioid was prescribed, it was more appropriate to have like Tylenol, right? So the problem is, you know, these things all have a role. Like even fentanyl, when properly used, is, you know, a proper medication. But the problem is these things, you know, you need gatekeepers.
I think it's good to have, from my point of view, it's good to have regulation so that they, you know, basically the FDA is after safety first. Totally. I think this is good. Like sometimes it is awkward. They make you do things which are really not necessary. But in general, if you take it the total picture, I think it's important to have FDA. Otherwise, we are going to have things which are not really efficacious and could be dangerous. So totally. I think it's a good thing.
Absolutely. And it's so, it's all part of the greater research. And we're part of that too. Diet is part of that too.
Exactly.
Raising awareness is part of that too. People, yeah, wouldn't pay attention to this if we didn't do podcast, if there weren't consumer stories, if there wasn't individuals out there saying that, hey, anecdotally, in my N of one, I started to feel better taking this. I started to see improvements that are there. And most importantly, like you're talking about in your new book, Total Gut Balance, Fix Your Microbiome Fast for Complete Digestive Wellness. There are so many practical things that we can all do today without pharmaceutical intervention to improve our digestive health and to have a better relationship between our microbiome and microbiome.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
When did you get the idea that you wanted to now go from research, which has inspired a product company, to I got to write a book?
You know, when I published that paper, I started to think.
The Crohn's disease one, Crohn's where everybody reached out.
And yes, that's the paper. And then another paper where the journal MBio contacted me and said, we'd like you to write an opinion piece about this, what's going on with the biofilm and this sort of thing. And then when I wrote that and put it together, I realized, you know, we should have some ways to try to control this. And that's where more and more data started to appear about how diet can influence the microbiome. And then I said, okay, we really need to think to balance not only the bacteria, but the fungi. And that will require a lot of research, a lot of data brought together to see how can we shift the balance in our favor rather than against us. And that's when I decided, let's put a book together, because it's amazing how much information you can put and you see, wow, this is gonna work. You know, the interesting thing is once we put the diet together, we really did a test. We had people enrolled in the study.
Like a beta for the book?
Beta for the book, because we wanted to see, okay, does it really make work. A difference?
Right.
You know? And to our delight, it really made a difference. You know, people who have GI issues, they resolved. Some people who had low energy, they really have increase in energy, less fatigue. Other people slept better. And really to our also surprise, people lost weight up to 10 pounds in 4 weeks. So that was really an eye-opener that, okay, this diet proof that if you can change the microbiome, you will be able to have less inflammation, lose weight, and be well. And you know, it's so interesting when we put all this together, I thought, oh my goodness, that's really very pleasing. Because again, as I mentioned before, as a professor, you do all these basic science, and then suddenly this is really applied to people, and you can see people are doing better. So that's
Afif, you were involved in the book and putting it together and supporting your dad and getting his research out there. What's something that you learned yourself in the process of putting this together? Because a research trial and all the great work that your dad does is great, and it's for academia, and that's important. That's what this all is based off of. But then you have to turn it into a consumer application, something that people can read and then implement. Anything new you learned in putting in helping your dad put this book together?
Well, one of the things I learned is don't assume what you know in what you're doing every day is just common knowledge. That's one of the hardest things I think when, you know, dad and I are going back and forth like 10 times a day, we talk all the time, that a lot of things we just take for granted that he's aware of, or we know that's something that we need to make sure is accessible. Because if the message is, it doesn't matter if, like, he's published all this work, doesn't matter if it's not accessible and understandable to the audience. The main thing I learned was honestly the shift, how fast it can shift on the fungi. Because I obviously I knew there were different communities. I did not appreciate how sort of entrenched bacteria is in the equation versus fungi.
You know, the other thing which I didn't mention in the trial, in addition to looking at their symptoms and how they improved, we also took stool samples before at baseline and at the end, and we were able to show that there is shift in both the bacteria and the fungi towards better profile. So this is, in a way, it proves that by shifting the structure of the microbiome, you are going to have better health.
Yeah, and the other thing, Dad, that we've learned through all the gut testing that we've done is that everybody thinks, and it seems that because it's not like your genetics, your microbiome can change. If some, if your genetics change, you were in the wrong place, like something went awfully wrong, right? But even though it's dynamic and can shift, about 98% of people that have taken our test fall into one of a number of clusters, pretty predictably. That surprised me because I really had the impression it's almost like a fingerprint that it's everybody's individually. It's not. The vast majority of people fall in the predictable clusters. And that was something that I think even you were a little surprised
about.
Yeah,
because people think like we are all individual, like every one of us have his own microbiome. There are some personal variation, but really when you put it all together, we looked at about 1,000 person who are quote unquote healthy. They are not taking antibiotics. They don't have any health issues or antifungal. They don't are on any medications. And we tried to compare their profiles. PCA analysis, it's called. And we saw that there are three different groups of people out of these 1,000. You know, one group is the biggest, and then two other. That's with respect to the bacteria. But what's so interesting, these three different groups could have plus fungi or no fungi, you know, with respect to Candida in particular. So now, we have personalized approach, but instead of having each individual person to group of people, which really was fascinating.
Incredible. And another plug for the book comes out on December 24th. It's an opportunity to learn, for people to dive deep into the world of the microbiome, but with really like practical solutions that are available for them to begin to understand not only why it's important, but how they can take control of it and start to have that better relationship between the microbiome and the microbiome. I want to talk about and share a really cool story that was recently featured, I believe in NPR, right?
Yes.
You know, your work, you're an immigrant to this country. And when you first came here, all this work is built on this idea of how you started your career. But if it wasn't for one very special person who helped you in that process, none of this might have happened, or maybe you would have been in a different area.
Sure.
So I would love to just tell that story just briefly. It's such a feel-good story. If either one of you...
Yeah, let me show off for him because he... So... We actually were living in Kuwait up till 1990, and during, my mom's English, and so we would go to England every year, and during 1990 was obviously the invasion of Kuwait. So we went from fun summer vacation to literally everything in two suitcases. So my dad had been that summer invited to a conference on like the medicinal uses of garlic in DC. And this is 1990. There's no like...
Just any old conference.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
It was the first Congress on the biology of garlic.
Right. Who was the host? The garlic?
Right.
I think there were some people, the organizer, I forgot now, but I know the organizers were from California.
Okay, got it. The garlic growers of California.
Yeah, exactly. So, and again, this is like pre like Expedia. Like he had a set of tickets, right? Like already sent to him. And he said to my mom, like, and there's three of us living, you know, we lost everything. I was 10, my sister's 6, my brother's like—
Because of the war?
Because of the war.
Yeah.
So, you know, it'd been on the local news in England and we had nowhere to live, right? Because like assets are frozen, like this is nothing, right? So a local university gave us a dorm for us to live in. So my dad said to my mom, like, I have this ticket to this conference, like, let me see if I can get a job, right? So gets to Washington, and again, like, this is the part, like, I'm his age now, 39, when he was going through this, and I can't imagine things like, there's no credit cards, there's no, like, PayPal, there's nothing, right? Yeah. So he had a little bit of money.
No, nothing.
Yeah. So, you know, he's telling me about this later, but, like, literally, like, apples in the conference type stuff, right? So he's asking everybody, he and my mom recreated his curriculum vitae, his resume, and he's going around this conference in D.C., he's like, look, are you guys hiring? And all the guys are like the working scientists, like lab, like technicians. They say, you know, we're not really the people that hire people. There's a conference next week, actually in DC. That's the one you have to be at, right? So he's totally despondent because there's like, he's headed back to London the next day and there's no job, there's no money, like no nothing, right? So he's walking around DC, he sees his travel agency. So he walks in and, you know, we joke that my dad, like with his accent, if he goes to Taco Bell, will get six hamburgers. Like he, you know, so this is like 30 years ago. He walks in and he says to this guy, like, I need your help. I need you to change this ticket and I can't pay you. Right. Cause he had a friend in Milwaukee. So he's like, if I can just get there again, there's no cell phone. Like Rick, I need to stay. Like I'm just going to show up in Milwaukee and figure out my next move. Right. So he says, I need you to change this ticket for me. Guys, it's like, I can't do that. I, you know, I'd lose my job. My dad's like, I'm struggling. I need your help. Right. And he told the guy the story for like a couple hours. Guy reaches into his wallet. He pays for my dad's ticket change. And then he gives my dad $80. Like, so my dad could like basically get a taxi and stuff. Dad goes to Milwaukee, comes back to DC, gets two job offers, and ended up, we came to here, LA, and he was at UCLA. So this is, this store, this guy changed our life, right?
Incredible act of kindness.
And again, like I think of I'm literally my dad's age when this happened. I think, you know, I'd like to think I would do it, but that's a big ask if someone was like, can you pay hundreds of dollars? Like you're a stranger. I don't know. Maybe this guy's real name is Larry and he's from, you know, Fort Lauderdale. Like, you know what I mean? Like, is it a scam? You don't know.
Right.
So this like kind of became a family legend, right? We tell this story, this travel agent, and people always ask like, well, do you know who the guy is? And we're like, no, you know, we don't.
What happened to him?
Yeah, you know, so literally probably like a month and a half ago, someone asked and they're like, well, that's really stupid. Like find this guy, right? So I literally put a Facebook post and I just put like all caps, like, were you a travel agent in DC in 1991? And I described the story. It gets shared like 1,000 times and the Washington Post sees it. So they reach out and, you know, they verify everything, get a hold of us. I'm like, whoa, you know, and dad's background, like as a scientist. So they write an article and the second comment, this woman's like, this is my boss. His name was Jimmy. It's making me like upset even thinking about it. This guy's name's Jimmy Dorsey, right? So they send us a picture of this, you know, older African-American dad's like, yeah, I'm not sure it's him. Get a hold of his wife. She sends us pictures and my dad starts like crying, like this is him, right? And so we tracked this guy down. He had passed away 6 months ago.
Oh my gosh.
So we missed this guy by 6 months, but like it has been the biggest blessing because, you know, and someone said this to me, like if someone in you are close to passes away and someone tells you a funny story that you've never heard about him, like it feels great. These people, their families, like multiple stories in the Washington Post about like, he's our angel. Like he's a, you know, just really, and the guy was like a volunteer firefighter. He's just a good person, right? And the craziest part is his niece lives three streets down from my parents in Cleveland. The guy's originally from Cleveland.
Your destiny is like intertwined.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. So we're actually going to go visit his wife and his kids in a couple weeks, but it was like, you know, just insane.
It's unbelievable. Like I told Afif, you know, like it's not like if you stop and you rationally think about it, would you do it? I don't think you'll do it.
And I think that it's not just the money aspect. A lot of people are just on edge and they're worried, is this person scamming me? Is this going to be something else?
Yeah.
You know, and so we're just, so sometimes through society, the situation, you may not have time because you're really busy.
I told him, I told Afif and the family, you know, when I got the jobs and I was on my way back to England because I had to wait for my visa to come back to the US, you know, to UCLA, I was crying because I could not believe it. Like I could get a job, you know, at that time. So
one person, we are very like a new
human.
Changed a generation
It really did.
Multiple generations for a family.
100%. Because England's like one of those places too. It's tough if you're not ingrained in that society. Like you can't. You know, it's not like you. That's the one thing people don't realize about the U.S. Like it is possible. It's not easy to make it, but like my God, everybody has a shot. You know, and that's all that's what that guy gave us was a shot, you know, and
it shows, you know, we are all a human being. And then if you do something that impacts somebody's life, it's unbelievable. Like it's just great.
What a beautiful message to end on there. And just this idea of spreading kindness, because that also, I'm sure, positively impacts the microbiome, right? Being a happy person, being real. I know people who don't have the best diets in the world, but they're so committed to service. They're so committed to giving back. You know, they're so committed to being there for other people. And that's a big part of their purpose. And they're happy and they're content. And most importantly, they're making the world a better place.
I agree.
And that's why our diets and these things are great. we do all that stuff so we can go and give back, so we can make a difference, so we can change people's lives. It's not just to see, get the award of who can be the healthiest.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Right? It's to actually make a purpose and a difference in this planet.
I really agree. I always say, look, we are all human beings. We are all trying to have the same thing and do the same thing. We need to take care of our kids. We want to educate them. We need to, you know, just make sure they have good health and this sort of thing. But that's, I travel, as you know, around the world, and everywhere you go, human beings are human beings, and that's what's so beauty of this world.
Incredible. Afif, Dr. G, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Where can people find out more about you? And you also have a course coming up, like a master's class.
Yeah,
so I'd
love
for you to just give a couple mentions for the company, for the book, where people can find all this, and social media.
Absolutely. So for Biome, just biomehealth.com, BIOHM health.com. And that's where we have our probiotics and our gut tests. For his site and the book, drmicrobiome.com, drmicrobiome.com, or on Amazon, it's Total Gut Balance is the book. And then on the course, drmicrobiome.com, really that's for people that the book is going to be interesting to them, but these are people that want like a helping hand, like a personalized approach, one-on-one help to actually optimize their diet, see exactly how to really do things in a group coaching with nutritionist type setting.
Incredible. Well, congratulations.
Thank
you. Can't wait for the book to be out there, and appreciate you both. And thank you for coming
on
the Broken Brain Podcast.
And the last thing I'll say is serious thank you to you, Drew, because since day one, when honestly we were just building our relationship, you were just incredibly helpful, and we honestly won't ever forget that. Seriously, thank you.
Thank you very much for
having us. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I cannot beat this guy. His English is better than mine.
Well, the sentiment is deeply felt, and I'm excited for the impact that your work will continue to make.
All right, thank you both. All right, take care.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.